have 60 seconds to comply.
I think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You have 60 seconds to comply. This is minute 51.
Part man?
Part machine.
All part.
This minute begins with cool dudes don't look at explosions. They just walk away. And ends with visceral mechanical penetration.
Oh yeah, I was definitely going to bring up the first spike shot of this movie.
It's fucking sick.
Yeah, I kind of just didn't bother doing much notes about the rest of the Emil scene because I was just like, I just want to get onto the server room. But yeah, it's Emil just gets fucked up.
My mommy says that I have the language of a trucker, and I don't know what she means.
Oh, just listening back to the last few minutes worth of Batminutes and the amount of bleeps that come out of both of us, I feel like I was the worst offender. But
we're Australian; we can't fucking help it.
Well, I think it's the problem with we're going on a PG podcast that we're an R-rated one.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've done Alien, and this is RoboCop. Like, this isn't for kiddies.
We literally end each episode with RoboCock. It's and we're not talking about roosters. Unless someone wants to do a rooster RoboCop fan art, please send it to us.
Yes.
We've seen enough robo penises on the internet, so, you know, maybe a bit of a turn. That could be a potential merchandising. Anyway. So, yeah, we got Big Bada Boom. And
Big Bada Boom.
So it's funny because, like, in the script and everything, it's all like, you know, he's just there going, you know, you're dead, you're dead. And in this one, it's like, yeah, Emil can't say anything because he's admittedly, rightly so, completely screwed.
Yeah.
I think it's funny, like, when he turns back up later on in the movie, you just realize, oh, yeah, there's probably been some time passed between these two things. So, yeah, he's probably just well enough.
There's something about filming on actual film in the 1980s.
Mm.
Fire, oh, yeah. Nighttime, it's just... In my soul, that is where I always am. You know, that is, aesthetically, it speaks to me on a very deep spiritual level.
Yeah, I think there's two things you just really can't replicate in movies, let alone film or digital. Mm. There's just two things you can't replicate in CGI as well as the practical thing.
Oh, and neon lights also.
Well, yeah, okay. You can replicate it. Neon lights, neon lights are cool. Yeah, we all know that. Yeah, cool. Two things you can't replicate in CGI, practical is always better, is flame and blood.
Yeah.
CGI blood sucked.
Oh, for sure.
Flat out.
But also, just in terms of what we do with the digital cameras, I think, tend to smooth and glossify everything. And then the post-production tends to do that as well. And I would say one of the few... I wouldn't say the only, but one of the few examples of modern digital cameras and post-production effects really working to the greatest advantage is the NBC Hannibal series, where it really is those deep, rich jewel tones. It is glossy. It's very editorial. It looks like a fashion magazine, but it has the most gruesome content. And yeah, I think that's where someone really... had an understanding of the technology and what that technology can be used to achieve. Whereas, yeah, to get that beautiful 80s quality, you basically have to use the technology of the time. And
yes and no, but keep going.
Because I've been watching things like Why Women Kill is a good example. So that takes place in... It jumps around. There's a modern segment, there's the 80s, and there's the 50s. And everything looks accurate, you know, cars, houses, everything. But it's like, what is it missing?
Something's missing. Mm.
It's how it's filmed. And the only example I can think of that sort of gets close is WandaVision. And still, you know, there's this very modern digital quality going on. They haven't degraded the quality enough for it to really pass.
That becomes a question of aesthetic.
Yeah,
because it's weird that because people expect a new product to look new, even if they're mimicking an old style. Yeah. So yeah, it's one of those things where
they couldn't go too far.
Yeah, if they'd have actually added a lot of like a higher contrast for saying some of the black and whites, things to actually mimic, or like maybe cut down the resolution and like maybe add some scan bars or something like that, some scan lines.
Pillar bars, yeah.
Yeah, you'll probably find a lot of people complain. They're going, I just paid this money to Disney Plus and I'm getting this shit. Yeah, so it's always going to be a toss-up between matching the aesthetics and having a quality. So, yeah, I completely get all that. But, yeah, there's always going to be something about... Well, literally, there's going to be something about shooting on celluloid because... You got grain. It's unavoidable. Yeah,
and I love John Carpenter, and I've been going through his filmography, and he really was the king of the 1980s. But then something happens, and I mean, the quality of the films overall go down, but it especially loses that beautiful visual quality that his films in the 80s had. And
the cinematography in a lot of his 80s stuff was fantastic.
Oh my god, there's something about the camera he uses that just makes everything look so massive. It's just, gorgeous. I could go on for days about it.
Yeah, it's like he started shooting on VHS and just was like, what the hell happened here?
Going through his filmography, it's like I begin and it's joyous, glorious. It is just the pinnacle of the 80s. And then as it sort of tapers off and becomes this really sad... dissolve, this disintegration into the 90s and beyond.
Well, it's his last Hollywood feature was Big Trouble in Little China, wasn't it? He started going more indie after that. Well, a lot of Hollywood didn't want to touch him. And then you ended up like things like Escape from LA, which were just like rehashes of his better films.
Yeah, because, I mean, he did do Christine, which amazes me that he wanted to do Christine. Which is, you know, Stephen King, big mainstream thing, and it feels like his own film, and he didn't really lose it. So, director, what was the last thing? This is total tangent, but I'm on this thought now, so... oh god, Ghost of Mars! Sorry, it was driving nuts. 2001, Ghost of Mars.
I've not seen that. The only movie I know roughly about that year that I've seen of John Carpenter's was that goddamn Dracula or vampire...
John Carpenter's Vampires, which is...
Vampires, that's it, yes. And I keep getting that confused with Dracula 2000.
Yeah, I don't know why. The Ward is really, really bad. That was 2010 and just feels like a 2010 movie. Yeah.
John Carpenter's Vampires is horrendous. And I've drunk watched that and... James Woods, Jesus.
Oh, he did The Mouth of Man... Yeah, 90s John Carpenter is weird. Anyway, we're way off track. Anyway.
So, the funny thing is, so we're getting to the point now where a lot of modern filmmakers want to work digital because it's just easier and there's a lot of advantages to working digital. But they chase the aesthetics of an older production. And the thing is, nowadays, it's starting to get there. The cinematography on Knives Out is all digital, but it really has this great aesthetic. So it's like it's achievable, but it really depends on your camera, equipment, cinematographer, all that other stuff, the director. And god damn it, Knives Out is such a great movie, and it has such a rich color palette and stuff like that you never used to get. You know, it doesn't have those flat colors or anything that you do associate with, or the post-production kind of shit.
Yeah.
And I love that film. I love that movie so much.
It's so good.
Shout out to the Knives Out Minute by Minute, which I haven't got around to watching, but I know it exists. So, I can't do that one, which is... Damn it.
This is too many.
Too many. Too many. Where were we? Silver Room.
Yes.
Unless you've got some more minute notes.
Nah, I think I've had my fill of flames and neon and... night lighting.
So, I love this server room. Apparently, this was a real place. Ed said it was shot at a place called CompuLab. But I don't think it's the company that's currently around, because that was apparently formed in the 90s. But this was a real lab.
It's a real brown quality to the shelves. It makes it look so dated.
So, yeah, for those who don't know, this is the internet. Okay, it's not the internet, but this is the kind of thing where networking, this is all a networking system. So it's just, yeah, racks and racks and racks of computer hardware all linked up together. Monday server rooms are exactly like this, but a lot more Cat5. And they're usually air-conditioned because they produce a tremendous amount of heat.
Oh, yeah.
So,
That was actually a lot of fun in my Knight Rider fanfiction. I have no shame. Yeah, I write Knight Rider fanfiction. It's like 40,000 words. I don't care. Anyway.
You look like crap.
Fuck you, kid!
But yeah, coming into that story with modern technical knowledge and going, okay, so there's, yeah, there's probably server rooms and there's all this sort of stuff. And these cars could integrate with that information and all that. Mm. Yeah, and yet, I mean, okay, Knight Rider's not the best example, but, you know, you do have things like Tron and RoboCop that have at least some sort of understanding, and whether the audience at the time really knew what they were looking at or not, because they took those measures, it means that they are more relevant to us now. We understand it more now.
Yeah. It's interesting how society has caught up with a lot of this science fiction, where I probably couldn't tell you what a server room was back in nine years old back in the day. But it's interesting looking back now, and yeah, that's like the funny thing is, like, oh god, I love this aesthetic, you know. It's I've worked in server rooms briefly in my life, and I'm a computer tech guy, so it's like, you know, just, you know, seeing all this old ancient hardware. And but it also fits in with this, like, retro-futurism that RoboCop's going on. So it's just a great shot.
That's the beauty of this RoboCop, the original one, is that it is so thoroughly its own aesthetic that it feels timeless. I don't think it would matter if you're watching this movie 20, 40 years from now. It's just so perfectly itself. You don't expect it to be anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, back in the day, you know, you didn't necessarily think it was a future movie, because it was, you know, except for the fact that it's just, because it just felt like a Monday movie just with a robot.
Well, it's like the superhero movies now where, okay, Ant-Man has this amazing technology, but it's not future technology, it's now technology.
Yeah, and I like how they kept it obscure in the timeline, so it just feels like its own chunk of...
Paul Rudd's paid me $50 to say that instead of saying Iron Man, by the way.
No, I think the problem with Iron Man is that it still feels a little bit too science fantasy. I mean, okay, Ant-Man, yeah, the whole shrinking molecules, it's a superhero, it's a basic conceit, you pretty much have to get over it.
Paul Rudd actually wants everyone to know that there was no special effects used for Ant-Man. That is all scientifically plausible, yeah.
Yeah, no. I was just about to say, the thing is, he's a Methodist actor, so, you know, he just, you know, shrank down himself. There's technology involved, no special effects. That was just him.
Yeah, it also says here that when he was small, people had to refer to him as Small Rudd.
Oh, Jesus, I didn't know about that. Okay, that's a bit of egotism I never would expect from Paul Rudd.
This is how he got into the small mindset, I assume. I mean, this is all in an email, so I can't really read tone. It may be a joke, I don't know. But also, there's a gif here from Mac and Me. I don't know what that
is. Damn, he was trying to figure a way to crowbar that in. Damn it. Anyway,
we can see in this scene that as 44 seconds in, that the costumes having a bit of a literal wobbly at the back there. The seam is not happy. It's kind of buckling. I wonder if it's actually heat that has caused it to do that. Is this room as hot as a server room actually is normally?
Well, I think the racks were a server room, but I think the console area could be somewhere else. Maybe some another place within the computer department. Because server rooms don't tend to have, or at least they usually don't tend to have, a terminal like that. They might have, you know, okay, yeah, it might be different for that. But this is also definitely a bit of set dressing, literally, so they could have the input terminal for RoboCop. But also, yeah, I don't think Peter Weller, you know, got his hand amputated to put a spike in there. So, yeah, they had to do some finagling to get the
true.
The spike.
That's the opposite hand. Hang on, is it the opposite? Yeah, it's the opposite one.
yeah, so it's one of those things where it's a bit janky when you really focus on it, but you know, when you're just watching it casually, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
And but this is the setup for a later payoff, you know, and you go, why does RoboCop have a spike? Well, he has to interface with the computer, so yeah, it's technically good enough. It's never going to turn out to be a weapon later.
Yeah. I do love that imagery, though, because I think it is something inherently violent and yet sexual about it, if I may get a little giga. And yeah, I think it's a very deliberate choice in that respect.
Well, there's not much difference between the script, the book, and the movie, except for the fact they all refer to it as a strip. So I'm not sure what the writers, because it's not mentioned in the commentary, so I'm not sure if Ed or, I'm trying to think of the other, Michael Miner, I think. I'm not sure if they were imagining something else, but it, because I would just call this a spike. It's yeah, a spike.
Strip sounds more like on a video game cartridge from back in the day.
Exactly. So unless that's what they were thinking, like it was something that shot, you know, same kind of mechanism, but it would look vastly different. But I don't know. I think the spike is, and also you got that great intimidation scene. You know what it reminds me of? The scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark with what's his face? The Nazi Black Closet Tot.
Yeah.
You know, Marion is there and she's been captured and he pulls out this bar and a chain and looks all menacing and then he hooks it around onto itself and it turns out to be a coat hanger. Same kind of energy, like, you know, brings up the spike, a bit of a, you know, bit of an up yours, and then it's done. Oh, it's a data spike.
But yeah, I think it was a very deliberate choice there. It's a visual gag as well, because oh Jesus, that's a weapon. Oh no, it's not. A very intense USB.
Yeah, is RoboCop gonna punch him in the face with the spike? No, yeah. He wouldn't do that. He's got to uphold the law.
But I actually, spoils, in my aforementioned Knight Rider fanfiction, actually, I'll write original fiction and I can talk about that and be proud of it. But this was an original idea. Just had this thing where Carr has this data interface thing, which, you know, it's like a tentacly phallic looking thing, and Kit doesn't have that. And so I was playing with these ideas of Kit is the neutered version of Carr. Carr has all this freedom and autonomy, and he has access to whatever information he wants. There's nothing you can keep Carr out of, whereas Kit is controlled, he's collared, he's limited, he's emasculated. So I loved playing with those themes there.
As soon as you said that, I was like, oh yeah. Although my brain also went to a bit of R2-D2, and it could get a little bit slash fiction-y there. it's especially if Kit and Carr interface.
Yeah, ooh, isn't that incest? I don't know.
I don't know. Would such a concept exist between mechanical devices?
I'll do the fingering.
well, this is where a concept like gender turns up in regards to like things like Transformers. Oh. Like, what makes a male robot and a female robot? They're fucking robots.
Oh my god, it so annoys me. later comics, not, this is relevant. They don't draw the female characters looking, you know, typically feminine anymore. Like, female is to robots just a very abstract social construct. It is not a biological thing. It's totally divorced from that.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much gender. But no, what I'm getting at is, why do they have masculine or feminine
at all? So back in the day they had 12 primes and each prime shit. I did all the research and
yeah. That said, I'm gonna set my Twitter profile to gender prime.
Gender prime, yeah, there was basically one prime and her thing was gender prime, yeah, fucking anyway. But yeah, the idea, NBC back in the day had a real issue with a particular episode of Knight Rider, because they were worried it would be gay. So Michael loses his memory. He's very vulnerable. He's afraid. And Kit's just like, no.
I think I remember this.
It's my boyfriend, and I must protect him. And they were just getting really lovey-dovey in that episode, and I loved it. It was so good. Yeah, it was gay. Hell yeah. But
I'm guessing in context, it was a flashback episode.
No, actually. Surprisingly, all original footage, but he was going through his past in the present, you know, finding his old precinct and all that. But yeah, the NBC was very concerned. It's like, this is gay. Like, okay, hang on. So NBC says, yes, mechanophilia, no homosexuality. So,
well, wouldn't that technically be teledildonics at that point?
I don't question. Yeah. And it's like, because I definitely
bring back teledildonics.
Did we mention that in the show?
We have.
Yeah, we have. Okay. Yeah, because my car's female, and I'm a lesbian. So I don't know if is that connected, and like, do we? Mm-hmm. Is it related to our sexuality that most men call cars she? I tend to just look at a car. That's a he. That's a she. And it's not even like about appearance. It's just like get a vibe.
This is a thing I've always had a trouble with when, like, especially when, like, a language genders an object. Like, trying to learn French and trying to remember what is the feminine, the masculine, and for what object, and that, I just short-circuited trying to remember that, and it just, I don't get it. I just do not get it.
Yeah, I don't, and it actually affects get it with cars, the
I don't get it with planes, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The psychology of the speaker of that language. So if a chair is feminine, everyone speaking the language is likely to look at a chair as a feminine thing.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that's always, I don't know. Even traveling in high school, it was just one of those things where I just don't get it. Mm. And yeah. But even like, you know, people like you named your car.
Mm.
That's just the thing that just never occurs to me, and I've tried it in the past, it just doesn't work for me. I just go, the car.
Yeah, that's like with my computers or my phone. I can't, you know, sometimes I give them a code name just like so I can see with the Wi-Fi or whatever connections.
That's a different thing. That's just an identifier, but
Well, because I've been writing the sentient car essay, I've realized that we relate through the computer. It is an extension of ourselves, whereas for most people, the car or a house even is the other. It takes on a quality, a life of its own. And also, these are very expensive things that can be passed down from generation to generation. So that, I think, you know, computers are just so disposable. I don't have an emotional response. I mean, I appreciate them, but I can't see them in that way.
I think some people do. Like, you get now, like, especially with, like, gamer culture, so we're getting people who approach a computer in the same way they would probably approach a car, in that sense of, you know, they spend a lot of time, they, you know, especially now with, like, gamer lighting and stuff like that, so they worry so much about the aesthetics and stuff like
that. That's true, yeah, whereas I'm just looking at a grey slab that folds open. You know, there's no face there. You know, Ivy has our face, and if she looks different from every other car on the road.
Yeah, my gamer box is currently underneath the desk, so I never actually look at it. I have to reach under to turn the thing on, but yeah, I got gamer lights because you can't get a freaking CPU fan for my high powered processor that's not got LED strips, so it's just like, I've just set it to one color, and you're like, nah, don't care, it's out of the way.
So, on the screen that Robocop logs into, it says access 001. So, is that his number? He got 001.
No!
Highest
clearance. Division OCP. Yep. I've got that written down exactly as well. I should mention that we see the return of Cecil, who was Sergeant Reed's offsider in the locker scene, the guy with the cardboard box.
Mm.
And he is an Australian actor by the name of Leard Stewart.
Mm.
And he's done a lot of TV, and you would like this. He's actually been in Miami Vice.
Not exactly up my alley, style and persona-wise.
Playing second policeman.
Oh, wow.
And it was the role immediately after RoboCop.
Nice. So he's just got typecast a little bit there.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I'm looking through his credits, like cop, cop, reporter, cop.
It happens all the time. I think it was on this show. We're talking about some other actor. Oh, yeah, it was the guy who was dealing with a hostage situation. Like, that dude just mostly played cops through his entire career.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just... I only brought it up mostly because I just wanted to get the Miami Vice connection in there.
We haven't used the drop in a while.
Yeah, no, I used it the other week. But yeah, it's always good to get a good drop in there.
What's the drop? I can't remember.
It's the, I think it's the Crockett saying, you don't have my style.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
He's got a great voice. Yeah. Miami Vice, pal. Real husky. Yeah.
Sadly, no Star Trek connection, because we haven't had one of them in a while.
I have not seen a Star Trek connection in Miami Vice. I do look out, by the way, I do.
Oh, damn. Well, maybe one day. So, yeah, he was acting all the way up until 2009. And the last feature film he was in was The Girl Next Door, which was the girl from 24. It was Eliza Cuthbert.
Oh, yeah.
She was she's like the Playboy bunny that moves into like the horny teenage boy next door movie. I never saw it, but I just know it because I've seen trailers. Although personal agreements, it's always annoying when it's like, here's an actress who's a Playboy bunny and she never gets naked. I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, yeah, except they're already brought up the Compu Lab. Paul mentions that the actual interrogation scene with Emil in front of the car had to be shot not long after the explosion. So basically, they set up the explosion, second unit prepped Emil and Peter Weller, and that's when I think that's what I was talking about last minute, about the second AD shooting it. And they had to rush it because they just couldn't, you know, reset on fire a petrol station. So basically, explosion, wait for it to die down, take the shot. Ed also remarks that in regards to this sequence with the server room, that this would normally be a very boring exposition sequence, and that he's surprised that a lot of people really enjoy it. Oh, and it turns out a lot of the extras in this scene are actually the crew members. And they do list them out, but I didn't write them all down. So if you want to figure out who's who, go listen to the commentary.
Yeah, I think we talked about before, just exposition isn't necessarily a bad thing if you can do it in an entertaining way. And
yes,
I've been told that my writing tends to move along almost too fast sometimes. It's very cinematic, I guess, because yeah, when I'm writing a story, I'm definitely seeing the movie in my head. And I mean, I like slower paced films sometimes. I love David Lynch, for example. I don't know how people do, or, you know, on a literary level, Stephen King, you know, The Stand's like 1,000-something pages. It never feels like it's frustrating or boring, but yeah, I don't have that skill.
I think it's one of those things where as long as it's engaging in, like, for example, it's informative, realistically speaking, dialogue in a movie should have...
Informative or intriguing, yeah. Just made me think, yeah, because like with David Lynch, it's intriguing because you go, okay, I've just been watching this person walk down a hallway in silence, but I haven't even looked away for a second because it's the intrigue. It's like, this is going somewhere. I know it's going somewhere.
Well, this is basic editing 101, and this is not just like film editing. This is story editing. This is any kind of editing. Does it serve the plot? If and statement, does it serve the plot? No, get rid of it. And if it doesn't serve the plot, does it serve the character? If not, get rid of it. If it's something should have a purpose in a script, in a story. If it's not serving the plot, if it's not serving the character, or it's not building, it's not let's say foreshadowing or anything like that, get rid of it. What was the other one? We brought up a couple times. Enter late, leave early. That's a thing of, we don't need to know Bob Morton opened the door. Bob Morton walked through the door. Bob Morton closed the door. Bob Morton zipped down his fly. Bob Morton got out his robocock. You don't need to know all that. You just need to know Bob Morton goes into the executive lounge and takes a piss and mocks Dick Jones. You know, sometimes concise is great, and visual storytelling, you don't even need to say half this stuff. You just let the visuals do the work. This is where I'm getting sick and tired of modern day Hollywood, where it's like, we've got to explain everything. No, you don't.
It's origin stories all the way down also.
Yeah, I think dumbass things like CinemaSins have ruined Hollywood executives, and that's why we have to get the Cruella prequel about why she hates dogs. No, we don't need that. We just know she hates dogs.
That was a Buckwild movie, by the way.
I haven't seen it. I just was like, no, not interested. That's the first thing I could think of when it comes to, the problem with origin movies are fine. I remember people going apeshit because in Spider-Man Homecoming, they don't have the Uncle Benson, they don't have Peter getting his powers. It's like, we don't need it.
Well, yeah, Spider-Man's been done to death. But yeah, I tend to avoid origin stories because I think it's better to start in media res and to speculate about this. Like, Darth Vader will never be what he was when you only had the original trilogy and you were just left with that imagination. Ooh, the Clone Wars. Ooh, he used to be Obi-Wan's Padawan. Oh, fascinating. And now it's just...
Yeah.
That mystique's gone. It's dead.
Yeah. Sometimes explaining the origin can... That's why I am against prequels for the most part.
Mm.
It's because we don't need to know why Han Solo ended up at Mos Eisley Cantina. We don't need to know that.
Yeah.
We just know that he's there, he's a badass, he kills Guido, and he's a remorseless killer who turns into, you know, a handsome prince.
Mm. So, should we talk about gaslighting Robocop?
Alex, how do you feel?
I feel fine, Dr. Norton.
As Sellers says, it's a machine that thinks it's Alex Murphy. In my book, that's legal, and he's all over it.
My notes is Sellers, the gold standard of corporate America, for exactly that line.
Yeah.
It's legal in my book.
I do have to wonder, though, how many things in history with business and law that, someone just, a corporation, has better lawyers, and that's how they get away with it.
Oh, a lot. I mean, I don't think we'll ever in our lifetime know just how much corporate lawyer shenanigans just goes on.
When it comes to health and medicine and food, that's the scariest thing, you know. How much is a corporation saying, no, the nation should drink Coke?
That's it. Corporate lobbying, especially in America, don't get it wrong, even though it's technically illegal in Australia, we gab it. But corporate America lobbyists have so much power. You can just buy a senator and you can get through anything you want. Shit, this is how we ended up with the global financial crisis. Basically, all these banks were paying off congressmen and senators to let predatory loan laws get, or laws that prevented predatory loans from being enacted against low-income households. And they went, anyone could buy a house now. Oh, that's right. No one can pay the money for their house. Oh, we're just going to foreclose everything. Why has our economy gone to shit? Oh, we did a bad thing.
So, in this scene, Robocop's like, hey, Doc, what would happen if I tased some little asshole in a mechanical suit? And Morton's just like, I don't know, but we're all very keen to find out.
Okay, that is a good line. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this.
It was one of the more humanizing minutes. And costume note would be Liz Klein. She's basically wearing camo. I had to look real close. She's not wearing camo, but she's dressed appropriately for the event.
What? Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember it being camo. Actually, I think I've got my jacket similar to Sellers there. That's creepy. Yeah, I don't know what that is. It just looks like someone stabbed her with a paintbrush 5,000 times. That shot of Robo Flag at the end of the minute, it just looks creepy.
I wish they'd done more to blur the line between the other machines and RoboCop. So
yeah,
like, you really do feel like, oh, well, where's the line between these two beings, things? I don't even know how you word that.
Well, from a design aesthetic, it makes sense that if we go by the idea that RoboCop is essentially taking these things and shifting it sideways, there would be some similar aesthetic choices, like the shape of the head, the visor, and all that stuff is there. But if RoboCop was still, I don't know, silver...
That's one thing, yeah.
We could notice the difference. Yeah, I hate this costume. I really hate this costume. And I'm going to mock it, because in minute 58, we get a very good close-up of the mono boob, which now I'm looking at, it looks like Iron Man's head.
Yeah, or the other way, I mean, we've talked about this before, but yeah, you could have gone more grotesque or exaggerated, like in Alita Battle Angel.
Yeah, something to visually... And that's the other problem, is that because he's basically this black rubber on black rubber... I know it's supposed to be metal, but it looks like black rubber on black rubber
on black
rubber.
It just looks like the Batman Begins costume, basically.
Yes, exactly. You could not have put it more perfect, yes. It's just a black shape.
Yeah, I guess what we're saying here is the design has to say something. So yes, if you make it more exaggerated and grotesque, or if you make it so indistinguishable from the other robots, you know, that you could put them all in a lineup and, oh, until you see the lower half of Murphy's face, it's just a machine. That those things would be saying something, whereas I look at this and, well, I guess it works in thematically with this idea that it's just... the product of marketing, marketing research. It's a corporate product. There's all of that, but I mean, the whole film is very unappealing to look at. It's professionally done, but it's just beige. It's so very beige and flat, and there's nothing dynamic. Like, you know,
drink.
Imagine a you know, even a J.J. Abrams shooting this, or a Michael Bay. There would be a lot more.
Yeah.
At least the colours would be more vibrant, you'd have your lens flare, you'd have a much more lively camera. It might not be good. But at least there's energy, there's passion. I think you could never say either Abrams or Bay have produced flat or boring things. If anything, it's the opposite. It's too much.
I 100% agree with you. As much as I have criticisms of both those filmmakers, they've never had a visually boring film. They've had, well, one of them has a visually messy film, filmography, but never. Okay, Michael Bay's movies never stick in your mind for more than 5 seconds, but you never walk away going, that was just boring.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming, but it's never boring.
No, it's more like you are holding on for dear life on the back of a truck that you've jumped onto, and there's nowhere for you to go. And it's just like, oh god, it's still going.
So I'm actually just scrolling through this thing, and I'm actually looking at the battle damage. I make a joke about it looking like Iron Man's helmet, because like, his mono boob has got like a strike across his eyes, which is almost like skull-like in the highlights. But it's like, hang on, this now it looks even more like rubber. Because, like, there's no...
Yeah, when it takes battle damage, it doesn't make it look better or more dynamic.
There's some scoring, which I think is supposed to make it look like it's metal underneath. But the actual... It just looks like gouged rubber. It just looks like fucking gouged rubber. And his head looks like rubber.
It looks like when cosplayers make armor out of foam and they put all the scars. He's cosplaying as a Mass Effect character, basically.
No, because cosplayers wouldn't make this look. Knowing what went into this costume through the Stan Winston studio in that, I think that's what makes it ultimately even more disappointing, because it's like, God.
It's a studio that could have done a lot better if they were allowed to.
Yeah. Knowing what went into this makes it look even more. Makes it just aggravating.
A modern RoboCop could look sick as hell. And there's this design I see floating around with someone just sort of modernized it a little bit. And yeah, it's so frustrating because, like, the original RoboCop costume is amazing, but if you could make it with modern materials, with the same design principles in mind, it could be beautiful.
Yeah. Well, you also, like, I'm going, just thinking back to the paint, like, paintwork on RoboCop, where it's got all these kicking highlights, the purples and the blues, and if you know your metal paints, it does look like metal paint. It does look like paint. It's got the silver fleck reflections on it and so on. Either way, but it sells. It really sells that this is a metal thing, and this is a thing that's going to be tough.
It just looks like a man in a costume. I mean, we've told it before. It just looks like a man in a costume, and you don't believe it for a second. And yet, with the original RoboCop, you do.
Yeah. God. I don't want to turn this into the bitch-out session of the costume, but it's, but there's not much else to talk about. This really does sellers as the... That sounded weird as I say it out loud. But this really does paint Sellers as this ultimate corporatist. He doesn't really particularly give a shit about Murphy or anything like that. He just wants his, basically, his corporate greed. You know, he just wants to sell a product. He wants to cash in. And almost that thing where I wish, for a movie, again, that's throwing so much shit at the wall and it's not sticking. Yeah, again, either make this the main plot theme, or make RoboCop the main plot theme. Everything, this just, it's too diluted. It says a lot, but says nothing.
Yeah.
Talking loud and saying nothing.
Yep, that's a spoofy. Well, that's all my
notes. Yeah, I'm exhausted. it's been a long weekend.
Yes.
I'm all noted out.
So, where can we find you, Simon?
Probably in bed, just trying to, you know, rest up, and if I've got some energy, you can check me out on Helios Photos and Fandom Crossing, and hopefully one day in the near, not too distant future, next Sunday AD, I'll be doing Kung Pao Into the Fist podcast, or Kung Pao Into the Minute again. But where can the lovely viewers find you?
You can find me at travingdesigns.com, TRAVIAN, and that's where you will find the Bane photo shoot I mentioned in the last minute. The Covenant podcast is coming back soon. I took a couple of months off, did a hiatus, and now having more guests on. I've already recorded one guest, and...
Nice.
The thing is, now I'm moving... I've been dealing with my car, getting a license, getting Ivy repaired. It's just, my God, bad timing. So maybe the hiatus will be a little bit longer than I planned, but I am definitely coming back. Yeah. I have missed it. It's not like I ever hated podcasting. It's just, I think when you make yourself do the same thing week in, week out for 3 years, you go insane.
Yeah, I feel that. By the time this has come out, I should be on the maybe second or third week of a production run on top of my already busy schedule. So what the fuck am I doing?
And I just finally found the RoboCop car concept art. So I'll send that to you, Simon. Ooh. We'll put it in the footnotes.
Yeah, I'll try to remember to do that. While you're digesting all those podcasts, go check us out on Simplecast, Spotify, Google, Apple, and your favorite podcatching thing. If we're not on there, let us know, and we'll definitely try and get it on there. We also are on YouTube as well. Yes, we have YouTube. These things go up on the YouTube-tubes. Like, share, subscribe, write a review, give us 5 stars. Well, give us 4 stars. Give us stars. Probably not one. Yeah, give us something. Give us something good. Yeah. Feed the algorithm. All that jazz.
Until next time.
A very tired black rubber-looking rubber cock. With scorch marks.